One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside of sphere where the points of the cube were touching outside of the sphere.
This isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
I am George Knapp listening to that UFO podcast and having one hell of a good time.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy. Just before I introduce the guest for the show, I want to very quickly mention a couple of things for people who may not be on social media or constantly on Twitter like I am as well. Very quickly, you can vote for the podcast in the QTT Media Awards under New Society and Culture. The links will be in the description for this podcast as well. Thank you to everyone who has voted so far. And of course, anytime any of you choose to take the time to vote for the podcast in anything, it is greatly appreciated. A big thank you also to all the new listeners this month and anyone who has signed up as well to support the podcast and myself through Patreon. Really appreciate it. There are some more exclusive pods going up there soon with some more additional listener questions, and there's going to be some more stuff added in the coming weeks with myself and Dan joining me as well. And finally, excited to announce the next roundtable is going to be recorded in around 1 week, where Dan, Dave Partridge of Shadows Magazine and Undead Gaucho are going to join me to talk about the phenomenon in the world of movies. So we are going to look at movies throughout the last couple of decades, and we're going to ask the guys about their favourite representations of the phenomenon in various different movies and more. So we want to hear from you, your favourite representations of UFOs, aliens, UAPs, whatever it may be in those sorts of movies. Send them over, ideally via email, to ufouapam@gmail.com, or I'll put a public post on the Patreon so anyone can jump on and add theirs on there as well, and it's easier for me to find them all in one place. Phew. So, what a few weeks it's been and continues to be as we march towards a June deadline for the UAP Task Force report. I'll put in brackets, hopefully. Former pilots have been joining social media. There's a wave of media from prominent speakers and experts. And finally, the UK looking to take the discussion just a little bit more seriously as well. Dan is joining me on the podcast today. Dan, hello.
Hey, Andy. Thanks for inviting me on. It's always a pleasure. And it's doubly a pleasure because Sean is here.
Oh, and Sean's here as well. Dan's.
Did I ruin it?
Do you know what? You've ruined it because I had... do you know what? Let me do it, right? And I'm not going to edit this out. We'll just pretend Dan hasn't said anything, okay? One of those at the forefront of the media wave recently, making his fourth appearance on the podcast, a man quickly becoming one of the faces of the conversation, and there are not many better representatives themselves, Sean Cahill, like Dan.
Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's so good to be back.
You should have just disconnected. Like, no, this isn't the level you're used to anymore. Like, this doesn't happen on
amateurs.
Those other networks. Yeah. Listen, Sean, people straight away, their ears will be pricking up. And I genuinely say there's a lot of new listeners to the podcast. And I am lucky to keep in contact with Sean regularly. And genuinely, two or three times at least a week, I will get a message asking, who does the outro to the podcast? it's Sean, this Sean, yes, this Sean Cahill. It's called Goblin Problems, and you can find it on YouTube, SoundCloud, and it's free for everyone. If you want me to send you it, I'm happy forwarding on copies as well. And Sean, I have actually been asked if you have produced other music as well.
Sure.
Do you want to talk a little bit on
never
that?
Never professionally, no. It's always been a hobby. It was something I always did to pass my time. And since retirement, I've had a chance to really delve into it. And I'm not a great live musician. I'm very much someone who plays in Logic Pro or GarageBand. But I enjoy it a great deal. And there's some other songs on my... on my SoundCloud, and I've produced some score work for a few small productions. I helped Dave Beatty with the Nimitz Encounters, believe it or not, even though I'm not actually in front of the camera because I wasn't available due to History Channel at the time. Dave reached out to me and he allowed me to provide some music for the encounter, the Princeton encounter portion of the film. So that was really nice.
And Dave provided a question later on as well. So that's good. And while Sean has said he's not a live musician, that doesn't mean one day he won't play an acoustic unplugged version of the outro for us as well.
You could probably get me to do that. I just need a lot of time. I don't even know how to play my own songs.
A lot of time and a lot of bourbon. Yeah, that's fine. So listen, folks, there were so many questions sent in. It was ridiculous. So if you don't hear your question, I apologize. But there was a lot to get through as well. Just before we get to listener questions, and I'm wasting enough time, Ryan Graves has tweeted out today about a 6-tweet thread. And some of it, for me, seemed pretty interesting information. And it got a lot of people's eyes and lighting up on Twitter. Dan, do you mind just running through quickly what Ryan was talking about today regarding the gimbal object?
Yeah, of course. For people who aren't on Twitter, we've just had the absolute pleasure of having Ryan Graves and Alex Dietrich join. And they're imparting wisdom and details on us, and some fierce sass on Alex's part as well. really kind of fleshing out these encounters. So Ryan's tweet thread was just about how in the video, obviously, in the gimbal video, we just see the one object and the rotation. However, Ryan explained that there was a kind of wedge formation of objects just in front of that gimbal object that banked in a way that you would expect aircraft to bank. As they were banking, they kind of lost the wedge formation and then refound it as they came back round. But while that was happening, the actual gimbal object did not bank. It was kind of making those, you know, it was still making those erratic movements that we're also used to hearing about.
Sean, I asked you to have a quick check on that as well, and I don't know if that's stuff you knew about. Do you want to talk a little bit on that particular movement? Is that something you knew about already?
I did not. What are your thoughts on that? I was aware that there were other contacts. I'm pretty sure that I think the verbals were, there's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. And now we get a better picture of that. I'm really appreciative of Ryan coming forward and talking about that, because it gives us a better detailed idea of what was really going on out there. I think that's a lot heavier than I thought it was.
And it's, when you're talking about a formation in front of an object, is there anything that suddenly comes to your mind or what you're thinking if you hear there's an object that seems to be escorted almost by other objects? Is that something, again, you've come across in the past when looking at UAPs,
UFOs? Well, in studying the lore over the last few years, there have been a few patterns that do come out in the witness testimony. It doesn't always corroborate perfectly to the recent radar data that we've seen, but it's not unusual to see more than one craft, to see a formation of some kind, to see other craft in company, or even some smaller craft seeming to tend to a larger craft.
And that's what I was going to ask. Is it uncommon to see different craft together?
I wouldn't call it uncommon. No, I would say that it represents a distinct percentage of the sightings. I wouldn't want to quote that number, but it's there's enough of them that, no, that's not unusual.
Well, listen, there's a lot of questions in here as well, and we're going to get straight into them. The first one is sharp and to the point as well, from Dave Smethurst. Dave, thanks for the questions as always. Does Sean think there is an underwater base of UAPs near Catalina Island?
I err on the. I'm going to not beat around the bush with these. I think people would probably hang me in the square. I would err on the side of a possible yes on that one, only because I'm not saying it's likely necessarily, but I am saying that given the fact that they seem to keep being in the same areas, you can get water anywhere on the planet if they want water, unless they really like the fish in that area. You know, then it could just be the military assets are the attractor, but I don't know what the attractor is, but I think that given the technology, I don't think keeping station on the bottom of the seafloor or going beyond that with possibly a pressurized place to rest doesn't seem beyond me for that level of technology.
And Dan, I do want to hear your thoughts on that one. We have talked about those kind of things in the past as well, but Catalina Islands, very popular area, obviously famous for certain incidents as well. What are your thoughts on what may be under the water out there?
You want me to say kind of magical beings, and I'm not going to. It's a mystery. We know more about space than we do about the bottom of our oceans. And, you know, there are some areas of the world that are kind of pockmarked with things like lava tubes and things like that that are really hard to explore. So even the people, you know, like James Cameron, explorer of the sea, even the places that he's been down, you know, like Mariana's Trench, there's still no guarantee you're just going to land on the bottom and find what we're looking for, you know. It's going to be a little bit further out of the box than just a building on the seafloor.
Absolutely. Thank you for that one, gents. And Dave also asked, and this was something that had just slipped my mind as well, what has happened to the documentary that Sean and his friends were filming along with Lou Elizondo? Has it all been filmed, and was anything
interesting
found?
Well, a few things happened with that. Actually, we everything was going swimmingly, and then the news cycle changed. Our proof of concept was completed. We had some ideas for it. We had some different ideas of ways that we wanted to go with it and who would be involved and who would be where. But logistically, it never quite came together in the end. And then when the news cycle picked up, for us, this current heat wave that we're in right now, you know, being all over the place, you know, doing 3, 4, 5 interviews a day for a few of us, this is the peak of the wave. But we started paddling months ago. And so at the end of our project, Untitled UAP, we found ourselves having to pivot in one direction or the other. And frankly, infotainment and entertainment and television and, you know, that long pipeline of content creation and quality assurance and then distribution, that's a long period of time to inform folks. And when, as I keep saying, when the news cycle changed, we saw an opportunity to go in a different direction and to access more of the population with more salient information than we ever thought we could on television with a structured program.
And that sounds like a positive, but does that mean that for yourself and Lou and the others involved in the project, things moved quicker than you expected?
They certainly did. Things did move quicker than we expected. And that's not to say that we had any kind of timetable, but we had no indication that we had finally landed that grappling hook into the mountain of mainstream media. So I'll be honest with you when I say that across the board, a financial hit was taken. Not a red cent was made. No distribution was made. The footage may never even be used. We had some interesting things to share. We had some ways that we thought that we could go out there and show real science and show real-time observational data and start educating folks on this larger idea of a real UAP phenomenon that's not steeped in the nonsense we're all familiar with that can mess the subject up. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to quote the financials on it, but you could have bought a car with what we're not going to make back easily.
Well, hopefully something does come of that one day and you get some of that back as well. But I know you guys aren't in this to make money, because you're certainly not coming on podcasts like this for your time for any cash incentives anyway. I'll send you another bottle of whiskey at some point. Dave Lorimer had a question. Now, he talks about Lou and others commenting in the past about Greek mythology. And he wants to know, is there any connection in your view, Sean, that the Aegeus system is potentially attracting UAPs?
I have to point out the fact that that's a super conflated question. So we went from myth into the fact that the radar system is named after a mythical weapon of Zeus. I don't see a connection. Yes. I don't think the UAPs are like, they named it after Zeus's weapon, let's check it out. But I do think that if I'm getting out of the joke that I think I was trying to tell for a second, the upgrades to the radar to me seem to correspond to flaps or massive sightings. I think I confused some of the audience the other day on a different podcast when I said flaps. I think folks who know the UFO genre understand what that means, but that just means over a geographical area, there were numerous sightings of probably the same object or similar objects. So yeah, I think the radar upgrades are probably connected. It begs the question of why is the technological boundary so seemingly close throughout history? And why does the technological boundary seem to always just drag slightly ahead?
That's probably a good place for Dan. You had a question for Sean on his comments recently on, I believe it was Cuomo Prime. Doesn't work out in a Scottish accent saying that surname, but it was the 100 to 1,000 years. Dan, do you want to frame that? It probably follows on nicely.
Yeah, basically, Sean's appearance on Cuomo was fantastic. It was really great to see you on screen. You're so present in the community and you're so great at communicating some ideas. It was good to see you on there. And you made a comment about the technology being 100 to 1,000 years ahead of where we are. And I just wondered, for people who are intrigued by that comment, if you could maybe just elaborate.
Certainly, that's been that was a serious shock, because I've seen myself quoted as the government in regards to that phrasing, and instead of as an individual expressing an opinion. So, but I will say this, we're talking anti-gravity. We're talking absolute control of what is seen. So let's call it perfect stealth. I know people would argue that point, because obviously we see them all the time. That's a whole another sociological question as to whether or not they want us to, or whether they have crap technology that malfunctions all the time. I don't know. But I have to say that when I read all the dirds, and then when I examine all of the data that's in the public about the same technology, and when I listen to the experts in the field of quantum physics and astrophysics and string theory and other things like that, it's clear that the leaders in those fields, that they claim that this level of technology is much farther ahead of us than we are now. A lot of the mathematicians and the people who get heavy into the numbers, they often feel like we're a lot closer than that, but I think they're speaking about something different than production and operation and actual theoretical modeling.
Yeah, you mean they're potentially talking about producing papers that hypothesize that we could potentially do this, as opposed to let's get in touch with Tesla and
certainly
roll a couple
been,
of these off the production
We've been discussing
line.
The Akubari drive since the 90s, I believe. Some of these ideas are not new at all, and a lot of people, armchair skeptics as well, like to reach for these simple answers and go, it's all hogwash because I know this one thing happened one time. And that's horrible research.
It's the old TR3B comment, isn't it, that comes up all the time on that one, that, yeah, we've got those. And it's like, okay, yeah, sure, show me. On that as well, though, I just want to pick up on the language being used, because it seems people like yourself, Lou, Chris Mellon, others coming out, I'll just come out and ask it, Sean, like, do you tactically place certain phrases and comments like that in interviews? Because we hear things like, if you do a series of interviews over a couple of years, everyone's always picking something out, same with Lou or Chris or anyone else. And is it deliberate, or is it just that this stuff comes up eventually, or is it because of the timing you start to say things? Because a lot of people seem to wonder that, if it's tactical
in the moment, perhaps. You know, there's that moment where you decide, am I going to push myself off this cliff and say this thing or not? Because I'm going to have to, you know, you reap what you sow. You know, I'm in the middle of that right now with some of the things I said, obviously. But no, there is no ahead of time call on any of these. You know, I talk to you guys a lot. I talk to Dan almost every day, and I've been on interviews since I finished my housework this morning. You know, you and I were saying that, you know, you were doing something. I've been mopping the floor and doing dishes in between interviews. there's no team behind me. There's no one else in the room except my dog and my cat. My kids are upstairs Zooming at school. So for those who think that there's like this strategic tactical plan and all this other stuff, no, we've just been working our butts off. And in that moment, that's my belief. And I was asked in frame, he framed the question right, that I felt like I'm going to go for it. I'm going to say how I feel about this. And that's what a lot of that is we're finally getting an opportunity to, some people are asking the right questions so that we can give answers that we can back up if they want to ask about them later.
And I'm going to ask, have you said anything with all that media frenzy and the wave of media, the flaps of media, for a terminology used before, have you said anything afterwards you've thought, I shouldn't have said that, or anything you would take back or change?
If I could have found a way to say my 100 to 1,000 year comment and ensure that people would attribute it to an individual rather than the U.S. government, I would have framed it more carefully, certainly. I thought I had done my due diligence on that. But I think we all know, no offense to present company, but you can't trust the media to always take the context of the speaker and give dignity to it. So
we've got a lot of questions on technology and the interviews, 60 Minutes, all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to go slightly off the beaten track for the moment, just to break it up for you. Walker has a question asking you, have you had any contact with the Bledsoe family? And if not, what are your thoughts on their story?
I have not. No personal contact. I have three paintings hanging in my stairwell that are based on some stories that I was told by Lou and some of the crew from when they had met them. Those are relatively private, and they're saved for another person one day. But no, I've had no contact with the Bledsoes. Their story is very interesting to me. It matches stories of a lot of other people as well.
Dan, you had a question on a story Sean told on the Big Phone Home. I've got a question, but if you don't mind asking that first, it'll depend how I frame the question I would follow up with. If you want to unmute yourself, Dan, that would be wildly appreciated by both myself and the audience listening.
I'm having a great time on this interview. I started by spoiling. I've done a mute thing. I'm doing it so you guys don't have to. That's the way I think of it.
Thanks.
So on the Big Phone Home, there was a really lovely kind of subtle moment where you told the story about an event in your past that was, I think, the first time you'd kind of shared that. And I wondered if you might share the story of your heart attack again, just so people that didn't hear that might be familiar with the story. And also kind of let us know how you're doing now. I've had a lot of people ask me, is Sean okay?
Okay, Dan, because it's you. I'll talk about it. 2000, it was Friday the 13th, April of 2012. We were off the coast of Africa. It was the night of the big bingo game on board the USS Macon Island. I was the chief master at arms on board. And the command investigator. I worked for a senior chief petty officer, and a lieutenant was my security officer, and I had a pretty pretty professional group of folks I was working with. I was very stressed out at the time. I wasn't being the best husband and father in the world. I was drinking heavily when I was pulling into port. I was smoking a copious amounts of cigarettes, and I lived off of yelling at people and coffee, and that was about it. I found myself, I was leaving the chief petty officer's messing area where we live. And I reached up and pulled myself out of the scuttle because, below a certain level, we have all the decks secured. So I had to go through a hatch, and I kind of did a pull up on the way out because I had missed going to the gym that day. And my left arm started to feel quite tight. I went back to my office and I worked for a little while, and then eventually I realized that I was smart enough to know that I was experiencing a few of the symptoms of a heart attack. And being a first responder, I knew that I needed to at least go embarrass myself in medical. I went up there. I spoke to the senior chief petty officer who was on just kind of in his office because there was no emergency. The battle triage area, for lack of a better word, the sick bay that's ready to take the Marines, it wasn't manned. Anyway, to make a long story short, I they called everybody up, the cardiologist on board and everything. I was very lucky. They had no signs of a heart attack. They thought I might have been having a panic attack. Turns out 30 minutes later, all of the symptoms showed up and I put my clothes back on quickly and went back up to medical. And that was it. I had my massive heart attack on the table. It took 12 hours to get the ship within range of an African country called Djibouti, where we were closest to. We were on our way up into the up to wash off the dust from the Middle East from our equipment before we went back to the States up to I believe Aqaba, Jordan. But I was evacuated to Djibouti the next morning via, they gave me a clot buster. I had a 70-30% chance. The doctor said, basically, you're not going to make it. The ship's going to take a long time to get within helo range. We have to give you a clot buster. I don't remember the name of the compound, but it was a very high chance that I was going to bleed out. But I said, go for it. I got to talk to my wife on the phone. In case I didn't make it that day, to fix a few things. Learjet up to Germany. I spent a few days there. They put in a stent. I had what is classically called an out-of-body experience when they put in the stent. After that, it's been a long road of recovery of the trauma of the event. I'm fine now. I've been practicing a very clean keto-based lifestyle for quite a long time. My heart shows no damage now. My cardiologist claims that I somehow, not that mysteriously, it happens, but I was able to heal the heart muscle.
Thanks for sharing that as well.
Thank you.
I think Dan's going to say thanks too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sean, do you think on that you would still be as involved, or would you even have got involved in what you have now without that experience?
You know, that's a good question. It changed me quite a bit, but it didn't change me enough. I needed more kicks in the proverbial ass as the years went by to get where I am today. I don't know. I can't say. There were other subsequent things that I had a dream that really dedicated me to the more metaphysical and spiritual things that we discuss sometimes. As far as UAP goes, that's completely dedicated to Lou coming out. I won't put it on anything else. And I'll go to the mattresses for that, dude.
Yeah, no, and thanks for sharing that. Next question from Kreuzer. Noting the CNN interview on Cuomo Prime, it leaned on the threat of UFOs entering US airspace. The phenomenon has been violating US airspace for 50 plus years. He doesn't believe the threat is big enough to sell to the general public to get the buy-in. No evidence has been presented so far the phenomenon has attacked or looked like attacking US naval air or surface assets. Sean, do you believe the phenomenon is a perceived threat purely because it outpaces human technology, or is it the only viable way to get the phenomenon in the media's attention?
I think that's an excellent question. It's very well framed. I find that I'll say that in the beginning of that question, it's leading, because when we talk about something violating American airspace, for example, who sets the boundaries of that, and who has to abide by it? If these are things that don't fall under the Geneva Convention, et cetera, they're probably not violating anything. They're probably just going about their business. But that's an opinion and an assumption. And I think we should start there and work our way out and see if we see hostile activity. But the question for me is, when we talk about a threat narrative, okay, I hate to say I resent that phrase, but I do. Because it's only being used by people who are trying to make money off of the fear-based ideology behind a threat narrative. I don't have a threat narrative. I have a scientific and an investigatory and a military martial viewpoint. If I see something that is coming towards the area that I'm tasked to protect, I intend to identify it, to provide boundaries around it until I find out if it's friend or foe. We're in a weird spot with this now. So you can go on a place like CNN and you can get a certain slant, and you can go on an outlet like Fox and you can get a certain slant. You can go on one like maybe a far left leaning green party type show and you could get a completely different look at it. I don't feel the phenomena is a threat. Could the phenomena be a threat? Sure. Under a lot of different circumstances, I'm sure if we started poking what we're seeing out there, it's going to poke right back. But we need to find out more information before we start determining what's going to alarm us and what isn't. I think we should be alarmed that, holy crud, there they are. They're here. In fact, they're right there. But now we need to slow down and go, okay, well, we all seem to be all right, don't we? Let's examine this.
Next question I'm quite intrigued with, because I'm not sure how you're going to answer it when I was reading it. So this is from Craig, and he wants to know, what aspect of this would you like to see addressed by research or through declassification or acknowledgement within a government, group of governments, or from
the
first position
the very
of power?
First thing that I would like to see declassified is a workable, usable history of sightings that were not debunked or simply brushed under the carpet. I'd like a history of the relevant programs. I'd like to know what they studied. And at the end of the day, what I want to find out is, what didn't we study? What's missing? There's what I call the yucky parts of this that involve the things like abduction or cattle mutilation and things like that, which I stay away from at the moment. I know that there is forensic data. I know that there's physical data. I know that there is eyewitness testimony and regressive therapy testimony to be utilized there. But I feel like that should be separated from the nuts and bolts aspect until we are 100% sure that the nuts and bolts aspect that we're observing on radar and in other areas is 100% connected to this other aspect. And I don't have proof of that yet.
On that question, just to follow up then, do you think what we have had declassified or leaked or released, whatever people want to say, over the last couple of years, and more recently the Omaha footage, we had the Acorn / blimp footage from the debrief that got leaked, has that been helpful to what you and your colleagues are trying to achieve, or has it hindered?
I want to be careful here, because in no way do I want to disrespect the amazing work of gentlemen like George Knapp or Jeremy Corbell. I want to first point out the fact that I don't think a lot of people understand just how important those gentlemen have been to this fight, and that those gentlemen in some ways for a period of time would seem to me like they represented some of the only trusted agents that there may have been to get some of this information out. So I won't hear people besmirch them. However, I don't have a chain of custody on those videos. I don't know how they got from a ship or a unit to George or to Jeremy. I do trust them. However, I'm an investigator, so I don't touch those videos because I don't have a chain of custody. I don't have the origin information that they have. And so all of it's up in the air. So when you get people who are armchair skeptics who want to debunk something like that, I don't even give the debunking any daylight because I don't have a proper piece of evidence to work with.
And is that, again, I go back to when we done the Room 101 special, you mentioned having one source, and a video on its own is no use, a photograph on its own, a piece of testimony is no use. You have to have more. It's got to be the sum of its parts. So there's not enough with what's being released for you to,
right. And
to
that's,
really
and
consider
unfortunately,
it solid.
Unfortunately, I'm going to give away something here. When I say something's compelling, I'm saying, let me know when you got more evidence. I mean, those are really, really interesting photographs and video and other things. And I don't think anyone's trying to pull one over on us. Those are anomalous and they're unidentified. The question is are they exotic or are they near peer spoofing? I don't know.
Cool. Next up, Jared asks or says, the media coverage has been great, but it feels like the 5-minute segments are way too rushed for such a complex topic. Now, you're living that at the moment, Sean. What's it like going through those really short, intense interviews?
I've had a chance to discuss with Dan what my technique for interviews is, and it's actually kind of meditation-based. So I kind of give myself over to the conversation a little bit, and I respond to what's said. It's hectic. The amount of energy that it takes to live in that space for that period of time, and not fumble your words or worry about what you're going to say next or try to get ahead of the speaker, to just be in the moment. It takes a lot of energy out of you. So when I'm done with an interview, you know, there's a big sigh of relief.
But yeah, so it's quite intense. And Dan, you had a follow-up, I think, that would be quite good for that on media reception.
Yeah, that's right. You've done a number of interviews in other parts of the world now. And I just wondered if you could speak about the kind of reception and the way that the presenters you speak to in those parts of the world discuss the subject.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate in the last week, as we've discussed, to be on CNN here in the States. I've been on Globo News in Brazil. I was on Al Jura Network in the Middle East. Let me think. I've been on shows in the UK that have outreach all the way through Europe. So basically, I've been able to hit the African continent, everything but Asia and Antarctica in the last week. And presumably in this modern world, those areas are going to have access to these streams as well. It's been incredible. It's been a whirlwind. At no time have we been ridiculed. The Brazilian interview was very reminded me very much of like a 60 Minutes interview would in the States. The interview that I had with Al Jura questioned why we didn't shoot them down. They had a rather more aggressive slant to their questioning, which I felt like I had to kind of put some boundaries around to make sure that I didn't get words put in my mouth. As far as the Aussies go, I think they wouldn't surprise us. They were Aussies. They were awesome. The gentlemen were witty, and but they treated it with respect. And I've not felt ridiculed in this subject ever during an interview whatsoever.
And obviously, you've been on the UK radio, which is good to hear over here as well, on talk radio. How did you find that? Because we've got a vested interest in that with UAP Media UK. And I managed to get somehow on the BBC last week. And I got called for an interview, which was great, and doing my first one of those. Dan called up after you had been on talk radio and made a great point very eloquently based on what you had said as well. How did you find the UK treatment of the subject?
I thought that Patrick was very respectful. He was very open-minded. He runs a fast and tight ship there on his show, so he has to be able to pivot back and forth with a lot of subjects. But I felt that he treated it with dignity and class. The conversation that I had later in the day with Howard Hughes, which I'm not sure if that's aired yet, but that was equally, frankly, dignified. They treated the subject with a great deal of respect. And they took what I had to say on board, and I didn't feel ridiculed whatsoever. It was very refreshing to see a lack of stigma.
I know you were very popular with the hosts as well, so hopefully that's been passed through the chain of media in the UK, and we get to hear more of you and see more of you as well. Couple more questions. A lot of these have been from the Patreon so far, and then I've got a whole host, so we'll try and get through as many as we can. Now, this one's a little bit political, but I think it's a fair question. So from Brendan, he thinks that seems the government is trying to thread a very difficult needle, which is the disclosure of advanced technologies of a potentially non-human origin, while simultaneously not admitting to 70 plus years of cover-up and a stigma that they helped create. Does Sean think our leadership can or should pull that off?
So I think that's a very pragmatic way to look at it, but we have to be careful how we assign motive here. Again, I shy away from calling anything the government, because does that mean that 4 years ago, those people were the government for what happened 70 years ago? And now that we have a new administration, does that mean they're the government for the past mistakes? But I won't try to, you know, work around the answer on that. We need to come up with whistleblower protections. We need to find a way for the sins of the past to be not erased. But there are so many aspects to this. We could dedicate a 2-hour show to just talking about what it would be like if everything the UFO community thought was true turned out to be true. I can't imagine how you would ever. I don't know how a government could continue if they hadn't already put protections for past mistakes in place for something like that. I think the reparations would be insane to try to, you know, you would have people pulling class action lawsuits with the military for not protecting the airspace and things like that. And That's ridiculous. We wouldn't be able, what are we going to get out of that? So I know that there are people that feel that there are edges of this phenomenon that the government is responsible for. And that's we're going to have to investigate that if that's the case. I don't know anything about that. But it's going to be wild. It's really going to be, we have a wild future ahead of us as we start uncovering these things. We're going to have to be very mindful and pragmatic about the decisions we make.
Can I ask just a follow-up on that? If on the 1st of July, the report has come out, there's been a little bit of time to digest it, and we get some kind of confirmation that there is a non-human technology present and we know X, Y, and Z, do you think it's even still likely at that point we're going to find out about all those past events, even with that happening? And I mean things like Roswell, Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, or do you think that's just going to stay consigned to the past? And we, because the mainstream, the 99% who don't have an interest or a vested take on the subject, don't know or necessarily care about all that stuff. All they will know is there's something else out there. Let's look at it. Are they going to care about the past, or do you think that will just be the focus on the future?
That's a really good question. I think it's we'll see what the task force gives up first. If they're successful and they get even a modicum of buy-in from the other departments within, you know, and agencies, et cetera, within the United States government that have explored this topic. And let's be real, I'm not going to provide a list of agencies right now, but there were numerous agencies over the 70-year period who have investigated this. A number of them are embarrassed over the fact that they, in my opinion, that they investigated this and then never figured out what it was and never did anything with it. But there are other agencies, large agencies, let's say within the Department of Defense, that have obviously aided in studying this over the course of that period and have never stopped. It's time to tell us what you found out. It's time to tell all of us what we found out. And declassify the portions that are safe to declassify. I think you guys know how I feel about that. I don't think everything should be declassified. Some things are very dangerous, like recipes to chemical weapons should not be openly on the internet. So before I digress too much further.
No, that's fine. Next question. I'm going to give you a breather to have a quick drink. Dan, I'll give you it first, and then I'll ask Sean to come in with his thoughts as well. Dan, do you want to just share your thoughts? Because I don't think we've had the chance to talk about this openly yet. We've done it on Twitter back and forward and through various chats we're in. But President Biden, and the wording of the question is dodging the UAP question. I didn't see it like that, but I've shared my thoughts online. Dan, what did you think about the question put to President Biden and how he reacted?
Well, from my experience, they have a very Biden and Obama have a close relationship. You know, they work together a lot when Obama was in the White House. And I saw it as kind of, I imagined a scenario in my head where maybe behind the scenes, Biden was maybe asked when he was going to address it by Obama, and he played a little coy. So Obama made the move for him. Which drew a kind of bit of banterous hitting the ball back towards Obama. So I see it as playful, not necessarily as some people have read it as him kind of saying, ask Obama again, because he might give you a different answer that we know what these are. I see it as more of a kind of playful bat it back across. We'll get another comment from Obama because of course people will ask him. And as far as I'm concerned, Biden kind of put a target on his back by trying to, or by appearing to avoid the question.
So that question was from UAP Disclosure Now on Twitter. Same to you, Sean. What do you think about President Biden's reaction?
I fear that what we saw was the stigma coming out of from a different generation that may have a completely different view on this subject, that has already made up his mind on the subject. I hate to say that. I don't want to be accused of ageism at all, but I will say that as I have gotten older, I know that my I have had to be very careful not to set my opinions in stone, and to make sure that they're malleable as new information comes along. But I fear that what we saw was him caught off guard with something that at his age and station that he didn't think he was going to have to deal with, and it may be poppycock to him, and perhaps he needs another briefing.
Now, forgetting politics, because I don't have a vested interest in US politics per se. I don't care red, blue, whatever, different parties. It's politicians, it's all the same thing. And, you know, Sean's being funny on video, folks, you know, yep. So, but for me, I would ask then, is Kamala Harris a better person to ask that question to? And do you think you would get a similar response from her?
Full stop. I think that Kamala Harris has an understanding of the subject that is nuanced within the United States government. And I do think that that Ms. Harris is where a lot of people should possibly focus their attention.
Do you think they are going to be the people to help move this forward, or will they have any part to play in what happens after
I think it's very important that the people that are involved with informing the situation, and I got to be careful here because people put words in my mouth. But I think if we have the people that end up having an opportunity to brief Vice President Harris, they have to be careful how they approach this. There's a lot of people who want to rush forward and they want to tell people, we know what's happening. We know what's going on. I'll tell you where they're from. Don't listen to those guys. And we're trying to stay shoulders above those people with honest and correct data that's verifiable and that's backed up with the record. So I think she's the right person to approach. I think the people that get there are going to be what determine whether or not it becomes useful in the future.
Next up, it's a really difficult question for me to ask, not because of the quality, but the person's name is about the most difficult I can pronounce with a Scottish accent. So Carl Mann, it sounds like I'm saying Carl in Irish, but it's C-A-R-L.
I swear you said the same word over and over again.
What is the best... Yeah, I said that like four different ways and it just sounds the same. Like I could be saying various different things, but, and do you know what, Carl's actually a comedian, so he'll appreciate that. What is the best case outcome if the task force report turns out to be a bit of a dud? We've heard the phrase nothing burger getting thrown about and all that kind of stuff. Would it at least inspire more members of Congress to speak out?
I truly hope so. Because I feel that there would be near open rebellion in the people that are growing around the subject, because it's not just ufology. It's not just fans of late night cable TV anymore or radio. This is people are interested in this subject across the board now, whether they think that the timing on it is strange, which is just hyperbole in my opinion, because we've all been working so hard to get here. The fact that they just noticed that we've arrived doesn't mean that it's a nefarious plan of some sort. But kind of lost my train of thought. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Next up, I'm going to ask a question from Kim, and this is one I think if you've listened to the show for a long time, you'll know the answer. People might wonder why, when they speak to you, Sean, I and others mention Lou Elizondo quite a lot. They must be like, why does this guy constantly want to talk about Lou? But you're very close friends with Lou, and with so many new people to the subject that may have just seen your interviews or online or heard them on radio, Kim wants to know, how did you initially meet Lou, and what was it about Lou that made him you want to join up with him and kind of start the journey you've gone on?
A couple of days after the New York Times article came out, and it took probably actually maybe 4 or 5 days of discussion between my wife and I finally wrote, I wrote to Lou at To the Stars Academy, and I told him who I was, where I lived, what I'd seen, and that if he wanted to verify any of the data of the events, I was present on the bridge and I could cross-reference things and identify people on board the ship and help out. It was 9 months later, I got an email back from To the Stars. And then when I confirmed the receipt of that email, I got a phone call from Luis Elizondo. And I knew who he was. And I had spent the intervening 9 months learning everything I could about him, his program, where he came from, what he had done, UFOs, UAP, you name it, everything. Because if this guy was full of it, I was going to take him down. I was going to make sure that this person coming out of government trying to get rich off of the video of the thing that we saw in 04 was not going to make it. Then I met Lou, and when we first met here in San Diego, after Anthony LaPay came to the house with the crew and filmed, the portion that was here. We did an interview portion down by the pier, and Lou got changed in the parking lot. I was waiting on the pier, and he came walking down the pier, and both of us looked at each other and just got these huge grins on our faces and kind of shook our head and then started the interview. We had a weird minute where we felt like we recognized each other and we were sharing that. But then after the interview, I was in a rush to get the microphones off because I had some things I wanted to talk about off the record. He'd asked me a lot of interesting questions. I'd gotten a really great, I hate to say vibe from him, but I really trusted him. I've been trained to pay attention to people's micro expressions and their haptics and their body movements and things. And I really got a vibe that I could trust this guy. So as soon as we got the mics off, I said, hey, if you're not full of crap and if you're not trying to make a buck and you're really going to investigate this and bring honest to goodness truth to the people, I said, dude, I'm retired right now and I'm enjoying it, but I'll put my boots back on and I'll go to work for you. And it's been nonstop ever since. We're close friends. I'm not privy to classified information or state secrets or any of that nonsense. We've developed a way to speak to each other and maintain the dignity of the classification system and his NDAs, et cetera. But he's been able to share some impressions with me and they have helped form my worldview. But beyond that, this is work for us. This means a great deal to us. We truly believe in trying to get the truth out to as many people as possible.
Now, one of the follow-ups for that then was from Richard, and he wants to know, how is Lou doing? Because he feels Lou's tone has been more fervorish recently. He's been a little bit more feisty, potentially, in interviews. Have you seen that come across in Lou in his interviews recently, in the way he's talking? He's a little bit
I've
more
seen that.
Up for the fight,
I think Lou's got his dander up a little bit. This is a very pivotal time in the fight, so to speak. Number one, Lou's working damn near 24 hours a day. You guys happen to know this is my third interview today, and I have one after this. I'm handling that operational tempo pretty well, but I'm not flying back and forth all over the country, and I'm not under the same stress Lou is. So if some people want to ask how he's doing, I'd say Lou's doing fine, but he could use the positive support. He could use people listening to the message he's putting out there. And instead of trying to find out what he really means, listen to the words that he's saying. He's pretty direct in what he says. But I'll say this. Lou's an incredibly strong man, but he's a man just like the rest of us. So I hope he gets a rest soon.
Awesome. Dan, I think you want to come in on that. Unmuted, ideally, for the audience.
This guy.
Second time. I know this guy.
Amateur.
Would you believe I used to work in technology as well?
Yeah, you've told everyone.
I just realized we have our own chat. I'm like, who are these guys? Oh, it's Dan and Andy. Look at them.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, you're going to break the fourth wall if you do that. I don't know if you have a fourth wall via podcasting, but yeah, I just got a chat. I do know what? Spoilers. We've got a chat and I just asked Dan, did he have a question off the back of that, which he does. So I said, go for it at 8:54 p.m. recording time. So yeah, on you go, Dan.
So this past week, some people might have seen you on Expedition X in an episode called Aliens of the Deep. And I just wondered if you'd mind talking a little bit about that experience where you and Gary were interviewed, and also whether you'd seen the episode, because in the episode, there are two particularly interesting bits of footage. One where they kind of set up essentially like a mobile sky hub. And they see an object in the sky that makes some 90 degree turns, which there's some pretty startling movement. And then it kind of dives towards what they think is the ocean. But that wasn't quite in frame, so we can't say it. And then there was another bit of footage where they were setting up GoPros around the boat. And one of the presenters saw quite a large light in the water that they caught on camera. And I wondered if you'd seen those bits of footage and whether you could talk about them.
So at the beginning, you asked about the whole experience. And I'll just say in general, I had a great time with Gary Voorhees. They asked us to come out to Catalina. We were able to take the ferry out together and get to spend some time after not seeing each other in the intervening years since the Tic Tac incident. As far as the footage that you're talking about and the bioluminescence or whatever that was in the water that Phil saw, Phil and Jessica, the hosts that we were with on Expedition X, I didn't see any of that footage until it aired the other night. I had not seen any of the recreations. Gary and I were present for our interview portion at that campground on Catalina Island that was featured. And then I actually immediately left. I didn't hang around for the rest of the night. I had to get back home. I had actually come just from on location with Untitled UAP. Those are hard for me to comment on because, again, I don't know anything about those. I don't know how they were captured, how they were edited, how they were color graded, or what may have been done to the footage to make it presentable for the show. But I think all of us realize that that show is a reality television, I guess. So it's slightly structured. There's a slight... I don't want to take away from it. We would have to ask Phil and Jessica and the producers of that show the providence of that footage. I'm not aware that Lou hasn't said anything to me about that footage either, so I do not know.
I think with the reality show footage for anything, whether it's Skinwalker Ranch, if you've done something similar for Unidentified, there's always going to be a question thrown out that, oh, that was handy that you happened to be filming or set something up overnight and you caught something anomalous on camera. It's incredibly fortunate. But like you say, you can't say that it's not incredibly fortunate and it is something anomalous, or it's potentially something far more terrestrial with a more earthly Stephen Greer-esque explanation to it.
I think maybe they could have possibly done a better job maybe labeling some of it to let us know that if any of it was animation or representation, etc. But I have to say that what they captured is not that unusual. That is what goes on out there around the Channel Islands, Catalina, Guadalupe, etc. So none of those things were unusual. Those match all of the constant eyewitness reports that we received down around Ensenada when we were there in Guadalupe. And even I think I mentioned on another podcast or maybe to you guys on a phone call that we got out of the shuttle for the hotel. And I just announced, because Gary and I were joking with each other. I said, watch this. I'm going to get out and ask everybody who's seen a UFO. And I said, I'll bet you that somebody's going to pipe up. Dude, the painters that were getting into the shuttle van to go back down to the ferry who'd been house painting all weekend started whipping out their phones. And they all had pictures of green things zipping around the air above them. It's the quality is the thing. You know, the triangulation, the quality. But yeah, not unusual for that area.
Next up, question from Documenting Disclosure. That's a new podcast that's starting soon. Some guys on Twitter that I know that were really keen on the subject as well. They want to know that now that more people are coming forward on social media, such as Ryan Graves and Alex Dietrich, do you feel the stigma inside the military
is vanishing? That's an interesting question. I've spoken to a lot of military folks. I do it all the time because now... I get recognized on occasion. And so at that point, we might as well just have the 5-minute convo and see how you feel. 50-50. Strangely enough, it's the senior ranking people, the pilots, the retired captains, admirals, et cetera, that I know in the area that are kind of leaning around the corner at school functions and things and going, hey, man, you're Cahill, right? So that stuff's real, huh? The younger guys, if they're into it, they already know. But then you got the same younger guys who, if they didn't believe in it before, they haven't paid any attention to a lot of the news.
I'm going to address this because a lot of people have mentioned it online, and we talked earlier about there's not a lot of money, if at all, to be made in interviews like this or for far bigger networks and mainstream media. Some people have questioned Alex and Ryan's timing coming online. Ryan's had his Twitter account for like 9 years. It says there it was set up in 2012, but he's never really posted. And now he's in the conversation just after 60 Minutes. And Alex is the same. She's came out and done the interview. Her name was out there when it shouldn't have been previously, but now it's publicly, you know, known and talked about, and she's been on camera. She's appeared, and some people have questioned the timing and people like that wanting to get rich or get famous and get themselves out there. What would you say to people questioning motives of these people?
It just speaks on the psychology of the person that's projecting that level of greed, frankly. Where's the money at? I don't know, man. If somebody offers me a book deal someday and I get to tell the truth about something and they want to give me money, that doesn't bother me. You guys know that I can't stand the idea of selling truth, man. You know, I guess I use the analogy sometimes when we talk about experiencers. Like I say, if we're talking about dolphins, you know, an amazing, another creature in another medium where we don't live, When I go down to the beach here by my house and I see dolphins, I don't run home and wake my family up and say that I'm an experiencer and that I experienced dolphins. I witnessed a portion of my reality and I observed it. A lot of people, they just want to put all of their ideas and project their beliefs on top of this. I think Ryan and Alex are out here because they saw a 60 Minutes article, and because Lou went out there, and because Chris went out there, and all these other people stood up at a time when they knew they were already ridiculed within their own communities. You know, Alex had to fight to not have her name put out there. I'm not complaining, because I've tried to get my face in front of this camera to help discuss this for a long time, and I'm finally here. So I'm not going to pretend that I didn't try to get here. But not everybody wanted to get shoved out front. And having the courage to stand out front and tell the truth and say it with conviction, where's the money? But part of me says, how dare you? But I don't want to clutch my pearls right now.
No, that's a fair response. Dan, what would you say to that? You're really prominent in social media as well, and you interact with a lot of these people, and you're trusted, which obviously I speak to you, and that's how I've got to know you. What do you say to kind of people shooting these? Sean wants to come in on that, actually. Or is he just laughing on camera? But yeah, Dan, what do you say to that?
I'll be polite. Sometimes people can look a gift horse in the mouth. Like Sean said, lots of people are coming out, and the more people that come out, the more people that will come out. That doesn't mean it's planned. That doesn't mean there's a conspiracy. It means that we're all standing on each other's shoulders and making this happen. And we've done that for 70 years. This is just another version of that. I welcome more people coming out. I love the pilots commenting on Twitter. It's absolutely incredible, and it's a privilege. I don't quite get
it. I can't wait to get phased out because I'm not the most effective speaker. Yeah. I can't wait until someone comes along who does this better than I do. That all of us in this want to be replaced by somebody who can do it better. We just want this to succeed.
On that, I'm going to ask you another question on Lou. I know you've got another interview coming up, Sean, so we'll let you go very soon. And I have a ton more questions, so if you could come back soon to follow up on those after you've had a break and a rest, that would be great. But Uncle Gravity on Twitter was asking, Lou had said recently that he might start smashing dinnerware if the UAP task force report gets whitewashed. Is there anything Sean might have to add regarding raising the provocation in that circumstance? Do you have anything persuasive up your sleeve?
Yes. I told you guys I wouldn't beat around the bush and I wouldn't play with words. The answer is yes. I don't want people to speculate too hard on what having something up our sleeves means. But let me also put it in completely logical terms. A person with a career like Luis Elizondo and with friends like Chris Mellon that understand the way the government operates, when people of that stature who understand how the bureaucracy operates and how to move information, assets, and ideas within those organizations and between them, when those people realize that something has poisoned the well, they don't quit. They make sure that water is safe for the rest of us to drink before they ever give up. So if Lou says he's ready to break dinner plates, I'd lock up the china.
Are we going to see another piece of footage or a photograph a la a black triangle coming out of the water before the task force report,
well,
in your
opinion?
Well,
I think an interview that I was on today with George Knapp and Senator Harry Reid, which I was very honored to be in company with the two of them on Nevada Public Radio. George basically said, yep. He said that he and Jeremy have more. And there's more rounds in the chamber, and they're ready to pull trigger when the time is right. So I don't know when that time is right. I think that's going to be up to those gentlemen to see or to make that decision. But I look forward to what they have to offer. I may not be able to verify a chain of custody on it, but if it gets our task force, our Department of Defense, and yes, our government as a whole, to speak up or raise an eyebrow and open the books, I'm all for it.
One of the listener questions, I've lost it now on the myriad of questions that I'm not going to get to, but they did ask, and again, Sean, if you were leading things with this task force report and it or you were involved at a level where you could influence it, and it came out and didn't land, do you have or have you seen a piece of evidence that you could provide to the public that could totally change the conversation?
No, I'm not in possession of any evidence that would change the conversation. Honestly, I think that if I was, I would feel deceitful by holding it back. I think you understand that if I were to come into possession of information like that, and it were unclassified and it were legal for me to disseminate that information, I would want to do it in the most effective way possible. There might be a delay between receipt and release based on that, but I don't have anything like that right now.
Sean, to finish up, what are our next 4 weeks going to look like and lead up to this task force report?
I think you're going to see a lot of people trying to sow discord. I think you're going to see a lot of people that are going to want to get ahead of whatever they're going to release and discount it and say that it's garbage. I think all of your debunkers are going to probably, put on their best ties and wiggle their webcams around and give us their opinions. But those debunkers come and go. The programs have remained in place for the last 70 years. So whatever we get next week out of that report is going to inform our next steps. The UAPTF was the first solid step that we have ever had to get up towards UAP truth. So whatever the results of the task force's report, that's going to be our second step. Now, whether we step on it to take over this situation and crack it open, or whether we get what we deserve, that's what we'll see.
Dan, any closing thoughts to follow Sean, which isn't an easy task?
I have. Am I allowed one more question?
Oh, nope. That's all we've got time for, folks. Thanks for listening. No, yeah, go for it. Go for it, man.
I feel like I know what the answer is going to be here, but I kind of have to ask it because I know there'll be a bunch of people listening who are like, ask Sean about this. So during an interview with Max Moskowitz yesterday on YouTube, Lou Elizondo alluded to a UAP presence at Chernobyl. And I wondered if you knew anything about that, or why Lou maybe thought that.
I'm going to say yes, but only in a third party fashion, like we've heard about other sightings, et cetera. I have nothing official to say about it, but Lou has a different network. He's involved in different networks and gets different information from folks than I do. So I do know this, that if Lou said that there was activity that falls under the category of UAP in and around the area of Chernobyl, I believe that.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Are you done, Dan? Yeah. Is that okay? Yeah. No, that's a good question. And you know what? People might have been looking, going, why am I not asking about the interview Lou just done last night? I haven't seen it yet. It was that close, and yeah, life gets
also,
in the way.
Also, I would make a point, isn't Lou, as close as friends they are, I respect that they are two different people, and that sometimes you might just get an answer of,
I occasionally get to watch his interviews, but before this rush started, I watch all of his interviews, but now I can barely keep up, so.
Well, on behalf of everyone else as well, you're doing a great job, Sean. And that's not just me saying that as a friend and everything, but it's great to see you talking. You're a very popular character. I joked with Dan in my intro, I was going to mention you're the Dave Grohl of UFOs, because you seem universally liked, popular, and you seem to have a lot of chat show hosts falling in love with you on the air and declaring their love for your voice and everything as well. So keep up what you're doing. And I really do want to have you back on as soon as possible. Once you've had a break, though, because you do need that as well and some family time. So to finish off,
you guys are my friends. I hope that doesn't upset anyone in the areas of us being unbiased, but you guys are my friends. I know the three of us have no problem disagreeing with each other if we need to. But I love you guys, man. I will, Andy, open. Anytime you want me, that I can schedule in for you and Dan anytime. And that's not an invitation I'm extending to the rest of the world. You and I and the three of us, we've been in this from the beginning, and we're going to be in it until the end, man. So I appreciate you. Thank you.
Awesome. Dan, thank you. Sean, thank you.
Can't wait.
And we'll speak again soon. That is all for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. You can like, retweet and subscribe. That would all be very much appreciated. The shows are being uploaded onto YouTube as we speak more and more. You can sign up at patreon.com/thatufopodcast to access shows ad-free as well. Please get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Of course, on Twitter, it's @UFOUAPAM. And again, folks, as always, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer. A little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rat. Meditated again and stayed full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I helped out my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should take care of me. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me. If you really want to know who I think they'd be, then it's you and me and us and we and him and her and that and she and that thing over there and what's that, Jake? Consider your heart, consider time, consider your space, consider your lies, consider your life, consider your eyes.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.